Well, welcome to the first of our big events here in the Center for the Study of Human Rights in 2006. And we have right up here what it's about: why the human rights and environment movements must be allies, not adversaries. My name is Conor Geerty. I'm the director of the Center for the Study of Human Rights. I'm also chairing tonight, and I'm also speaking tonight because I did a PhD in environmental law, and it's never been used, never even published. I couldn't find it today. I couldn't find it when I was doing some research for my speech. I've lost it. But I vaguely remember what it was about, and I'm going to use some of it. It's the first time ever. It's probably submitted to the RAE, for all I know. But I'll come at the very end with a few very, very, as has already been indicated, trivial remarks. The star billing to address this issue is shared by our two guests. And Michael here, Michael Meacher, was educated at New College, Oxford, but much more importantly, at the London School of Economics. And he tells me that he was briefly teaching here. Is that right? It was actually here, Michael, before he was elected to Parliament. And that was some time ago, so he's been in Parliament for some time. But very, very importantly for our purposes, he was Minister of State for the Environment from May 1997, the election of the Labour government, right through to very recently, June 2003. And those of us who followed the environmental issues over the last 8 or 9 years in this country have known the extent to which Michael Meacher has made such a dramatic contribution in that area. So we're very interested to hear what Michael has to say on the subject. And he's going to be followed by David Wolfe. I have to declare, David is a colleague of mine at Matrix Chambers. He has an expertise in environmental law. So he's going to speak about the environment from the perspective of the activist practitioner. We have at Matrix Chambers a blurb which puts in bold type what solicitors say about barristers, and what they say of David includes things like he is the king of, unfortunately, education law, not environmental law, but he's certainly thought of very highly in environmental law, one of the best advocates I've seen, and then somebody else, clearly well practiced in deceit, almost magical. So David has practice in environmental law and a strong feel for the subject. So these are our two, plus me, panel speakers. And then we'll have a question and answer session at the end. And then we'll have our drinks, as usual, in the location yet to be disclosed. Though frequent visitors of the centre will know by now where they usually are, I have to say. It's not a special place. Can we start, therefore, with a round of applause for Michael Meacher?
I'll speak from here. Everyone can hear me, where I can see you and you can see me.
I'm sitting down, Michael. Can everybody hear?
Well, I have a very loud voice, and I probably don't even need the microphone. But can everyone hear, including the gallery? Yes. I seem to recall that there is a place where people say what they feel about politicians, too. It's not only what solicitors feel about barristers, and it's called the media. And we read about it every day. I just hope, David, that they're more complimentary about the barristers in Matrix Chambers than they are about politicians in the media. I also say this is rather unusual to have a chairman who has decided he wants to speak, which of course is his prerogative, but who's decided to do it at the end, which makes me slightly nervous. Since I well know in politics that the person who has the last word is in a very strong position, and I do indeed stand to be corrected. I must confess that I was a bit taken aback when I was first asked to debate this question of why the environmental and human rights movements should be allies rather than adversaries. Because I have to say, I had always taken the view that they were very close allies, and it had never occurred to me, actually, that they were anything else. Indeed, I perhaps would take the view that they're almost two sides of the same coin. However, having said that, I can see that there is perhaps one special case which it may indeed be perceived that there is a conflict, and that is if property rights are perceived as falling under the general heading of human rights. Now, of course, I realise, I'm not an environmental lawyer, but I do realise, of course, that property rights are encapsulated in the Convention on Human Rights. Nevertheless, of course, property rights have to be protected. I mean, no one is going to deny that. Of course, they shouldn't be arbitrarily expropriated or damaged, and of course, there should be redress. But it has, I must say, always seemed to me perverse to regard property rights as an instance of fundamental human rights, unless they are actually integral to the basic needs and survival of human beings. And I would concede at once that, for example, a peasant farmer in a developing country who has a subsistence holding and is then arbitrarily deprived of it by companies, whether indigenous or from the West, coming in and deciding that they want to put a lake there or they want to drive a pipeline through his land. And of course that is a breach of his human rights because it takes away his basic subsistence unless, of course, he is provided with a satisfactory alternative. But that, I think, is quite separate, at least in my mind, from the aggressive pursuit of property rights in a capitalist democracy such as ours. And in that case, which is perhaps the normal case in the north or the western part of the world, then I would say that that is as inimical to other people's human rights as it is to the environment. In other words, you have property rights on the other side to what is in fact a close mesh between the environment and human rights. This was charmingly portrayed for me, some of you may have seen it, in a recent article by George Monbiot, thank God for George Monbiot in our society, who wrote an article in The Guardian, which I have here, called "They Call Themselves Libertarians, I Think That They Are Antisocial Bastards." I'll come on to that in a second. He was referring to those who want to use their car, and I won't go into this, but he says an awful lot about this in the article, why the car is the symbol of exactly all that we're talking about. It's my property, and I want to do with it what I like. I want to do with it in any time I like, in any way I like, and at whatever speed I like, irrespective of other people's safety or indeed the environment. And he quotes a number of examples. For example, in the eyes of these people, towing away a car, albeit it may be parked in a place which is quite likely could well cause an accident to other people, that is an infringement of my rights. Or indeed speed cameras, another of the things that they are particularly keen on, I jest, which they feel very passionate about, is an infringement of human rights. Even though, of course, they clearly save the lives of many others. I'll give them one thing, however, that they have introduced a word to the English language which was new to me, but which is quite evocative, namely the word petrosexuals, which I think rather well illustrates their particular drives and commitment. Symbolised, perhaps above all, by someone you may know and have seen on television called Jeremy Clarkson. And Monbiot quotes him. In February of last year, he suggested that speed cameras might be, quote, filled with insulating foam that sets rock hard, unquote. And after the London bombings in July, he observed that, quote, many commuters are now switching to bicycles. Can I offer 5 handy hints to those setting out on a bike for the first time? I'm only going to give you 2. 1, do not cruise through red lights, because if I'm coming the other way, I will run you down for fun. 2, do not pull up at junctions in front of a line of traffic, because if I'm behind you, I will set off at normal speed and you will be crushed under my wheels. Anyway, you get the idea. Well, apart from the absurdities of this extreme case, where, in fact, of course, property demands are every bit as hostile to genuine human rights as they are to the environment, I think there is actually a wider argument. But that argument is much more subtle. And it's basically around a very fundamental question, I think. Who owns the environment? Is it nobody? In which case, presumably, it can be rapaciously exploited and polluted with impunity, regardless of the effects which that may have on the lives and the livelihoods of those who depend on forests, on waterways, on cultivated land, as is the case, of course, for billions of poor people. That, I suppose, is a view taken by President Bush and rather too many, I think, Western multinational corporations. Or is it owned by everybody? Do we have such a thing as collective human rights? In which case, how is the environment, environmental protection to be achieved in the absence of world governance, in the absence of having a World Environment Court, which I would see as matching or preferably overriding the WTO, and in the absence of any recognition of the destruction of human rights generated by unfettered free trade, wiping out local markets in developing countries and tipping millions of subsistence farmers into poverty. Something that happens most days, weeks, months of every year. Now, I think that's a very fundamental question. It's not just an academic or theoretical question. I think it's an incredibly practical one. So what is the answer? Well, I think that there has, as yet, been no convincing answer. I suppose that the Kyoto Protocol, which is now ratified, it's now live. Britain is one of the countries which has legal obligations under it, is perhaps the bravest and the most comprehensive international intervention yet attempted to protect both the environment and human rights of millions of people, hundreds of millions of people, whose livelihoods, indeed their lives, actually depend on protection against the threat of climate change. Indeed, something which some of you may know, but plenty of people do not, it is true in the worst outrage since the Second World War, namely the destruction of the Twin Towers, 3,000 people approximately died. But every year, silently and without any dissemination of the information, 150,000 people or more die as a result of the direct consequences of climate change. And indeed, I always like quoting the Pentagon because it's always such an extremely good source to have on one side. It is the Pentagon which says that climate change is now a much greater threat to humanity than international terrorism. But of course, the whole problem about Kyoto is that it is flawed. It is flawed in being incomplete. I was one of those who had the task of trying to negotiate it with about 150, 170 other countries. I can tell you that's quite a task. And to a degree, it's a remarkable success. But the fact is, of course, the United States hasn't signed up, China hasn't signed up, India hasn't signed up. And until they do, it is not going to be as effective as it's got to be. Why have they not signed up? Because they prefer to put economic growth in advance of both protection of the environment and the proclamation of human rights of those who may be ruined by worldwide unrestrained industrialization, something which is absolutely rampant now across the southern part of the world as well as the north, or by the reckless over-exploitation of natural resources. Now, that leads on to a wider question still, and I'm going to conclude with this. Can the assertion of human rights, that is, in the sense I'm talking about, the dependence of all of us, every single one of us, 6.5 billion now on this planet, on one single biosphere, it's our habitat, And if that habitat is destroyed, our survival is very much at risk. But can the assertion of that collective human rights be used to protect the ecological boundaries of what our Earth can tolerate? That's, I think, the central question. Well, I don't know the answer to that, although I've probably spent much of my political life to trying to bring one about. But I do think there are two interesting proposals have recently emerged about how this might be done, which I want to put before you. The first is that developing countries should seek legal redress from the other countries, that is our country, the industrialized countries, causing global warming. Now, you might say, well, okay, I see the point, but what's the real evidence? Well, for example, of course we could get far, far more evidence, I have no doubt. Australian and Canadian research recently found, and you may remember this, that the terrible drought in the Sahel and in the Ethiopian area of Central Africa in the mid-70s and mid-80s was now almost certainly caused by industrial and power generation pollution. That is the mix of sulfur with ammonium, nitrogen and other chemicals and gases, which grossly distorted and altered the weather conditions in Central Africa. Now, you might say, in terms of that damage and the quite enormous, the magnitude of the disaster that occurred then, there are indeed grounds for redress. Of course there are difficulties, and I say I'm not an environmental lawyer. Well, the main one is, of course, pinpointing the specific main causes of the pollution. But I do believe that there should be consideration given to a test case if one can assemble that evidence with a group of international lawyers as to whether the US or the EU could be brought to book, because we certainly caused it. Secondly, consider the whole concept of global debt and the 46 most heavily indebted poorest countries. The poorest countries that we did so well for at Gleneagles. I say that with a little bit of sarcasm, but with a certain degree of pride as well, but nothing like enough. They are required to make amends to us, the rich country creditors, who lent them money in the first place over the last 3 to 4 decades. And no one challenges that. Okay, they're very poor, but we lent them money, and under our economic system, if debtors do not repay, the whole financial system collapses, so they have to repay. We may give them a bit of debt remission, but they're expected to repay. Okay, why then, on the same principle, should we not have a concept of carbon debt? And by that I mean the industrialized countries who have become rich, not only on the basis of economic exploitation, a lot of people will assert that, but also on the basis of what some people call a dirty industrialization. That is an industrialization which made us rich, but which generated pollution in the atmosphere, in water, and across land, which is now generating climate change. Almost all the scientists in the world agree this, with increasing ferocity and destructiveness, of which, and it need not have been like this, but it so happens it is like this, the developing countries, who are in no sense responsible for this, and who are not the beneficiaries, but they are the ones who are the main victims. More than 90% of the effects of climate change, as it happens, have been visited on the developing countries, not on those who caused it. We all know about Hurricane Katrina. Yeah, Hurricane Katrina did fearful damage. But I tell you, the only reason you've ever heard of it is because it hit America. If it had hit Bangladesh or Africa, you would never have heard about it. And up till now, that's where it has hit. 1,000 people died in New Orleans. 100,000 died in Bangladesh in a cyclone about 15 years ago. So why shouldn't there be an assessment, internationally verified, perhaps through the UN, of the cumulative climate change damage inflicted on developing countries, with a requirement that the rich northern industrialized countries pay compensation? Is that such a totally unreasonable proposition? I don't think it is. Instead of global debt, making the poor South pay billions of pounds year after year to the rich North? How about carbon debt, which actually might reverse that flow of income back towards the South? This is not such an anomalous theory, I have to say, perhaps not only for the lawyers, but also for the economists, and I speak in the London School of Economics. The idea that economic externalities should be factored into the pricing system is not a new idea. It's an idea which is gaining increasing currency in many ways, and I think it is a very defensible and just idea. And I therefore conclude that environmental protection and human rights, in my view, so far from being in conflict, actually work in lockstep with each other. And I think it is no exaggeration to say that the survival of the human species may well depend on our capacity to ensure the protection of the biosphere from climate change, which is currently destroying it. And we may only be able to do that if we can assert and enforce the protection of the biosphere as the most fundamental human right of us all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike, for getting us off to such a good start. David, either here or at the desk as you wish. David Wolf.
Connor was kind enough to describe me as an activist practitioner. I would rather describe myself as a jobbing environmental lawyer, but also something of a campaigner against big business and political interests, which often seem to undervalue environmental protections. And sometimes I'm lucky enough in my professional life to find those two strands coming together. I'm also very much not a human rights lawyer, but I'm a lawyer who turns to human rights as a tool to assist in the other areas of work, in this case, environmental law. Before I turn to do that, before I describe how that might work and how it has worked in my experience, let me just illustrate to you what I mean by a typical environmental case in the world in which I work. It's a judicial review, typically, of a regulator's decision to grant permission for something potentially harmful or polluting. So that might be a local planning authority or the environment agency or a government minister. And it might be a waste disposal site or a nuclear power station or a new port or any such industrial polluting, potentially harmful activity. And the kind of cases I get involved in are the kind of cases where I act for communities or individuals who want to challenge those authorizations, who want to say that's unlawful because that's the vehicle of judicial review, in order, in one sense, to secure their environmental rights. And what's in play, sometimes it's the natural world, flora, fauna, landscape, sometimes it's individual health, safety, risk, all those kinds of factors. But I think even the people who bring the cases about landscape or flora and fauna would say that those are part of our collective environmental rights. And in protecting those rights, what we've traditionally done is looked to environmental legislation, some of it European, some of it domestic, vast screens of it. You can go to the Environmental Law Encyclopedia and it runs to about 5 volumes. There are incredibly detailed statutes and regulations which protect our environment and a whole raft of environmental decision makers that are supposed to do the same as well. So on the face of it, there's a lot there and a lot of protections. Just let me give you one example of the kinds of detail of protection that we now have. Across Europe, there is now an air pollution directive which came into force for these purposes last year, which sets very specific thresholds of what the levels of what are called PM10s, small dust particles, should be in the atmosphere. There are numbers which apply across Europe. You can't exceed a particular level of PM10s in any given location or more than 35 days in any one year, or that's a breach of European law. As it happens, that level's been breached quite frequently in London in the last year, and not much is being done about it. So immediately we see that the existing statutory environmental protections, even those that are very, very focused, very, very broadly consensual, that have been negotiated across Europe with big business interests in mind, are not providing us with sufficient protection, and yet they are there in great detail. What I then want to do is to explore the extent to which human rights instruments, particularly the European Convention as introduced through the Human Rights Act, has been able to plug some of those gaps, to plug any gaps that exist in our existing framework, even though it is so complicated and detailed. Because what I then want to talk about is whether, if they haven't done very well, there is actually scope and need, as in my mind there is, for more fundamental, proper environmental rights, rather than doing what we do at the moment and having to graft environmental rights into property rights or rights to respect for family life or whatever it may be, actually having some substantive environmental rights codified into our system. And what I want to do is to mention how some of those issues interplay, and this is really picking up on what Michael's talked about extensively, interplay with the way in which big business and commercial interests actually are overrepresented and overvalued in our current legal system and in the way that our environmental protections exist. Just let me take an example of how those sorts of things hit the news and hit the headlines. Even Monday this week, the lead item on News at 10 was about a change in the government's proposals for dealing with waste. Less waste disposal by landfill, more incineration. That's a very classic environmental question, waste disposal and its consequences. Lots of rights-based conclusions flowing from it around pollution and so on from waste disposal. And it's big news. And yet there is no movement, and I find this surprising, to turn that big news item and those sorts of big news issues into a call for proper environmental rights in our country. I want to talk about two very specific examples to illustrate the limited way in which European Convention protections have helped. Because I don't want to say they've made no difference at all. That would be wrong. I want to talk about two examples of how they've made a very limited benefit. One of them is in relation to the mobile phone network. One of them is in relation to the energy industry. So two very disparate industries, big business, huge commercial pressures in play. Before I do that, let me just explain something which is trite to environmental lawyers and indeed many other fields of law. That what we're talking about here is two sorts of protections, procedural protections and substantive protections. Of course, the person on the ground who's got the nuclear power station built near their house, which is now on our long-term horizon, doesn't much care whether what they're seeking to vindicate are procedural rights or substantive rights. They just want it stopped, or at least made as safe as possible. But nonetheless, as lawyers, we have to understand the difference between the procedural rights and the substantive rights. The procedural rights we're talking about here, when it comes to environmental law, are the right to information, the right to an assessment, the right to a proper decision maker who takes into account all the relevant factors and vindicates your rights in the striking of the balance. That's what I mean by procedural rights. Substantive rights, it's about the threshold. What is the limit of acceptable noise in the area around Heathrow? Quite how much dust can you have in the atmosphere? Or is this big project a good idea? Substantive rights. And what I'm going to explain to you is how human rights law has made a little bit of difference in extending our environmental procedural rights, but almost no difference in extending our environmental substantive rights. In terms of our environmental procedural rights, as they exist in our existing law, there's a whole raft of them. Some of them come from Europe. Those of you who study these things might have heard of the Environmental Impact Assessment Directive. It provides a requirement that the developer of a major project has to do an assessment and predictions around the impact of that project. They have to publish that assessment. They have to publish it in a very specific kind of document that's made available to the public. Public can look at it, make their comments, and the decision maker has to take those into account. Very crisp procedural rights. But that only applies to the very biggest sorts of projects. And even then, the assessment is done by the developer. And it often reads more as an act of advocacy than an act of true independent assessment. Contrast the United States, where there is a freestanding industry of environmental assessment which prides itself on its independence. I don't think the equivalent here could really hold its head up in the same way and make that claim. So there's a lot of scope, even within a European-wide environmental impact assessment regime, for improving access to that kind of information. But nonetheless, there are huge barriers to environmental claimants, whether they be NGOs or individuals vindicating their procedural rights. Just let me mention a couple of those barriers. The first of those barriers is the costs rule in the High Court. Those of you who know anything about how judicial review works know that if you bring a claim and you lose, you have to pay, or at least might have to pay, the other side's costs. And it's not unusual for somebody bringing a claim, particularly, say, an NGO, bringing a claim against a pollution permit granted by one of our statute regulators, to be told, well, if you fight us and lose, we'll bill you £100,000. then that's a huge disincentive to vindicating your environmental rights. Now, what we know is that the Aarhus Convention comes into force here next year, talks about our right to access to, amongst other things, an effective court system at a reasonable cost. What the government here is saying is, the reasonable cost in question is £150 it costs to launch the judicial review, quietly forgetting the massive disincentive that comes from the £100,000 you might have to pay if you try and fight and lose. So a huge inequality of arms, which is going unaddressed, notwithstanding certainly our European Union protections and arguably the Aarhus Convention protections. Big scope for addressing that, for allowing people to vindicate their procedural environmental rights. Let me talk about another one. If a big business or developer applies for planning permission from the local planning authority and they don't get it, they can appeal. They can appeal in what we call a merits appeal. They can argue the whole thing again before the Secretary of State, before an inspector. They get two bites of the cherry. If, on the other hand, the planning authority grants them the planning permission, local objectors have no equivalent right of appeal. All they can do is argue that the local planning authority acted unlawfully. That's not nearly as powerful a tool as the third-party right of appeal, which is what would be called in the jargon. In other words, the residents' rights to go to a tribunal and say, that permit shouldn't have been granted, not just that permit was unlawful. Now, there were attempts in the early days of the Human Rights Act to redress some of those things. So, for example, there were arguments in the early days of the Human Rights Act to say that Article 6, the provision which guarantees or should guarantee a right to an independent tribunal in the determination of your civil rights, that that created or required the creation of a merits tribunal, a third-party right of appeal. But unfortunately, those arguments failed. So there was a vehicle there for filling in the gaps in our existing system, for creating a more balanced environmental protection regime. But unfortunately, that vehicle, framed as it is, interpreted perhaps more problematically as it has been by our judges, hasn't provided the necessary protections. That's all rather gloomy. Let me be a little bit more positive and talk about two examples of instances where the Human Rights Act and the European Convention have, or might in the second case, provide us with enhanced protections over and above those which come from our basic statutory framework. The first concerns a case that was decided last year in the Court of Appeal. The second concerns a case which is in the Court of Appeal tomorrow. The first one I want to talk about concerns mobile phone masts. Britain is awash with mobile phone masts. We all want mobile phones. We all want good coverage. But what are the consequences? Ironically, a choice that was made by our government very early in the rolling out of the mobile phone networks has made things a lot worse for us, because what was decided in the UK is that rather than all the operators sharing a single network of masts, there should be a marketplace. So each of the operating companies had to produce their own network of masts. So Vodafone has to have one for every area, T-Mobile has to have one for every area, Orange have to have one for every area. So we have five times as many masts as we need, and actually lesser coverage than they do in the rest of Europe, because in the rest of Europe they have 100% coverage because they only have one network and the companies share. So we've made it worse before we start. Why does that matter? It matters because there are concerns not just about the landscape impacts of that, which is an environmental issue, but also because of the potential health concerns of mobile phone masts. There is a huge controversy about whether mobile phone masts and the emissions from them are harmful to health. Lots of science one way, lots of science the other way. You might well say the scientific jury is completely out. Now, the government a few years ago decided to try and put that all to bed by setting off a commission under an eminent scientist called Sir William Stewart, who was tasked with investigating the arguments one way or another about the science of mobile phone masts and answering this question once for all. The cynic in me says he was privately tasked to come back with a whitewash answer, don't worry, it's all safe, because of course that's what the industry wanted to hear and that's what government wanted to hear. Slightly alarmingly for all of us, and particularly for big business and government, I suspect, he came back and said, no such thing. What he said is, there is no positive evidence of harm from mobile phone masts, but we can't preclude the possibility. And therefore, he said, we should take a precautionary approach. And he manifested that in all sorts of different ways. Precautionary meaning, let's not commit ourselves to various things until the science is clearer, until we've ruled out the possibility of harm. Because apart from anything else, he said, the harm might come cumulatively over more years than we've now got experience of. So one of the things he advocated was, before you place a mobile phone mast anywhere near a school, consult with a school, and if the school objects, don't place the mast within 400 metres, roughly, of the school, a precautionary approach. Now, when the government received his report, they adopted a few bits of it. But, for example, the bit about masts near schools, instead of saying don't place it near the school, they said consult with the school, but then place it there if you want to anyway. So although you will see a reference to schools in both the Stewart report and in the government's response to it, the actual response was very different. Now, I think there's no coincidence here with the fact that the mobile phone companies are some of the biggest around. Vodafone is one of the biggest companies in Europe, £80 billion company, huge clout within the political marketplace. So immediately we see how their power has been manifested in that process. It's been manifested in another way, and this is more directly relevant to the human rights points I'm going to make in a second, which is about the process by which the mobile phone companies have to roll out their networks. Now, what I'm sure you know is that to build anything, a shed, a conservatory, let alone anything big or industrial, you need planning permission. Now, there's a regime within the planning system which says anything very small, like a shed or a small fence or a Velux window in your roof, is deemed to have planning permission. It gets it because it's recognised to be a small and innocuous and unconcerning activity. But all the big things, you need to go to the local planning authority, your local council, and say, can I have permission? You have to provide them with lots of information. They have to consult. There's a process. It's time-consuming. It's expensive. And the mobile phone industry didn't like it. So they negotiated a special deal, which in effect applies only to the mobile phone companies. And there's a fast-track regime through the planning system for them. You'll see where this is going in a second. And in that fast-track regime, all they have to do, they realised they couldn't get away with being so small as to be ignorable, like a fence or a Velux window. In that regime, rather than applying for planning permission and waiting for the local authority to answer one way or another, and then appealing if necessary, all they do is notify the local planning authority. And if after 56 days the local planning authority hasn't said stop, then they are deemed to have planning permission. So it's a special fast-track process which the mobile phone industry has negotiated uniquely of all industries. And I suspect there's lots of other industries that would love to have the same thing. But somehow this lot have got an extra way through the process. Of course, it relies on the local planning authority doing its bit. In steps Dr. Christine Nunn. Christine Nunn is a GP. She lives in a small village outside Leeds. She suffers from migraines, as do the rest of her family. They think it's a hereditary thing. And those migraines are made worse, amongst other things, by using mobile phones. And she thinks they will be made worse by having a mobile phone mast in the vicinity. Her bad luck is that she moved to this village precisely to be away from the sorts of urban industrial things which have triggered her migraines in the past, only to then discover T-Mobile wants to put a mobile phone mast or wanted to put a mobile phone mast effectively at the bottom of her garden in full view of her conservatory. Forget the property value effects. Let's talk about the health effects. She believed that that would have an adverse effect on her health. All that T-Mobile had done under the process I've described is they wrote to the local planning authority and said, we're proposing to do this. Local planning authority had 56 days to say no. Christine Nunn sought to persuade them to say no, partly in relation to her health concerns. She said, this will cause me health problems, please don't let it happen. They agreed with her, but they didn't send the piece of paper back within 56 days. It was 58 days. So T-Mobile, being a concerned bunch of people, said, tough. 58 days is more than 56. We're putting the mast up. Up goes the mast. Christine Nunn, being a sort of feisty individual, decides to take the case to the High Court. She wants to argue that this is a violation of her Article 6 rights. She says, the decision to place this mobile phone mast at the bottom of my garden is a determination of my civil rights. Amongst other things, my rights to environment and health. And because nobody has grappled with the merits of it in an operative way, that's a violation of my Article 6 rights. She goes to the High Court, and the High Court laughs at her, says, Article 6, you must be joking, this isn't a civil right. She goes to the Court of Appeal. Now, oddly, the Court of Appeal says, yes, this is a civil right. Now, in many ways, that was a remarkable result because the Court of Appeal and the High Court have ducked the question over several years of whether Article 6 applies to those kinds of environmental determinations. And here they were deciding, quite remarkably in my view, not remarkably in the sense that it was the right answer, but remarkably given the history, that this was indeed a determination of her civil rights, that there had been no determination by an independent body. The planning authority could have been that body, but because it messed up the notice periods, it hadn't given effect her Article 6 rights, and therefore there'd been a violation of her Article 6 rights. Win to that extent. Unfortunately, what the court then went on to do was to say, well, that doesn't mean that T-Mobile's permission is invalid or somehow unlawful. All it means is that you get compensation, a damages claim. But Christine Nunn is now claiming Human Rights Act damages for the violation of her Article 6 rights caused by Leeds City Council's failure, in effect, to fill the form in and get it back in the 56 days. That hasn't saved her mobile phone and saved her health, but what it has done is send a chill wind out to local authorities, and it's provided through the Human Rights Act and through Article 6 a limited, very limited, and that's really my point, bolstering of the existing procedural rights. And what it's done is it's gone a little way to moderate the excesses of the way in which the mobile phone industry has been able to plough its way through all the existing regimes. That's my first case study. The second one concerns Article 2 of the Human Rights Act, of the European Convention, I'm sorry, the right to protection of life. Before I tell you about the facts of this, I need to tell you about a case in the European Court that concerned the environment and Article 2. It was a case in Turkey where some people had been squatting on a landfill site, and the landfill site wasn't properly regulated, and a methane built up, and the landfill blew up, and 26 people were killed. They went, or rather their surviving relatives, went ultimately to the European Court and argued that this was a violation of their Article 2 rights to life. And what the European Court said, and this is a couple of years ago now, what they said was Article 2 was in play. First of all, interesting, Article 2, the right to life, in play in relation to environmental issues. See these people now dead. Secondly, the positive obligations under Article 2 were in play. In other words, it's not just about the state not actively killing you, it's about the state putting in place positive measures to protect your life against foreseeable risks. Step in the right direction. And then thirdly, where that takes us, where that took them, is to set out an obligation on the state to put in place a proper legislative regime that secures that positive right to protection from life, including, therefore, processes of assessment of risks, evaluation of those risks, and publication to the punters of those risks. So telling the state it has to put in place an array of necessary regulation, not saying to the state this is what it has to look like, but this is the result of it. Now, focus that then on our existing regime. I've already told you there's a vast array of regulators and a vast array of regulation and laws that protect our environmental rights, and perhaps you'd expect the greatest protection of all to be around risks of life and death. Funnily enough, however, the good citizens of Milford Haven haven't found that to be the case. They found themselves to be the location for what's proposed, or indeed now being built, two new liquefied natural gas terminals. Let me tell you about liquefied natural gas. Liquefied natural gas is gas that comes from underground gas fields all over the world, typically near the sea, so taking it away in a ship, this is where I'm going, is a good way of transporting it around the world. And this is where, again, touching back onto what Michael was saying a moment, there's then a fantastic Kyoto Protocol wheeze going on here, because what you do is you pump the gas up in Norway or bits of Africa or indeed parts of Australia, you pump it up, you compress it and cool it to minus 160 degrees centigrade, at which point it becomes a liquid, and you remove from it various pollutants, which mean that when it's then later on allowed to warm up, turn back into a gas and burnt, the CO2 emissions are very low. But that's the CO2 emissions at the point where you burn it. In the meantime, you've expended a huge amount of energy and therefore created a huge amount of CO2 in compressing and cooling it and in removing the pollutants from it. But that takes place at the point of production. So it's a brilliant wheeze for countries like the UK to import this fantastic source of energy, fantastic in this sense, source of energy, which gives us low CO2 emissions, because the CO2 emissions involved are taking place in other countries. Great wheeze. No wonder the UK is so keen on it, and we're very keen on it. Come on, ExxonMobil, one of the world's biggest oil companies, wants to build, them and another company, want to build a huge LNG terminal in Milford Haven. What happens here is huge container ships, each of which contains 250,000 tons of liquefied natural gas. That's a big ship. Come across the world, and they will come, the proposal goes, into Milford Haven Harbour, where they will park up. They'll connect by pipes to the shore. The liquefied natural gas we pump to shore, it'll then be warmed up, turned into back into gas from a liquid, and go into our national grid. In other countries, they've realised that this is not a very smart thing to do near people and near sources of danger and so on, so they are building offshore terminals. So you build your terminal offshore and then you pipe ashore the gas. So if there is a risk associated with a ship, it will happen somewhere out to sea. Not in the UK, though, because there are huge political and commercial imperatives around building in Milford Haven. For example, there is an old oil terminal there, so it is said makes great sense to build on the old oil terminal. Also, as it happens, ExxonMobil own the land already. Also, as it happens, it's very expensive to build offshore terminals. So, big political pressure coming from Whitehall and from the Welsh Assembly. Huge commercial pressure coming from ExxonMobil to do this in South Wales in Milford Haven. Problem is, right bang next to this old oil terminal and the site of this LNG terminal, 10,000 people live. Come back to the raft of environmental protections. Lots of processes involved, lots of bodies involved in giving permission for this thing to take place. So the local planning authority, the health and safety executive, the harbour authority, all of them involved in assessing, evaluating, giving consent for this activity to go ahead. And in due course, they went ahead and gave permission for it. Perhaps unsurprising, the locals thought, in the light of the huge political and commercial pressure that was being put upon them. But, and here comes the problem, the HSE, the Health and Safety Executive, had started off in their assessment process assessing not only the risks of a problem onshore, on the terminal, but also the risks associated with the offshore activities. So, the risks of bringing a huge pressurised gas canister into Milford Haven, turning it round in a narrow and crowded waterway, connecting up to the jetty, and pumping the gas off. Lots of scope, you might think, for things to go wrong, with potentially huge consequences. HSE started to do an assessment of those, as they've been called, marine risks. In the course of that assessment, they reached the conclusion that if there was a substantial leak from one of these ships in Milford Haven Harbour, a 4-mile-wide cloud of ultimately explosive gas could develop. All it would need is a single spark, and there would be a 4-mile-wide explosion over Milford Haven, something akin to the size of a small nuclear bomb. Now, before they'd finished their assessment, in comes the letter, and I've seen the letter from the ODPM saying, stop this assessment. This is not within your jurisdiction. Your jurisdiction stops at the quayside. So the HSE never concluded their assessment. The planning authority didn't do an assessment because they took the view that this wasn't a matter for them. They took the view it was for the harbour authority. But the harbour authority has a huge commercial interest in this project going ahead because it gets a fee every time a ship comes into the harbour. So perhaps you might think not so likely to say close this terminal down or don't open it in the first place. And they've also made it very clear that they see their role as controlling the ships in the harbour, not stopping them coming in the first place. Certainly no suggestion they would ever say, we've done a risk assessment and this thing shouldn't happen. So the poor old citizens of Milford Haven have now got, being built on their doorstep, this facility, there having been no assessment of the risks associated with the marine operations at all. Or at least there's claimed to be some assessments, but they're being withheld from us for reasons of commercial confidentiality. So not much comfort there in terms of what's actually being done. So our very, very sophisticated on the face of it and complicated regime of environmental protections and regulators has simply failed to provide an assessment of a very obvious risk with very serious consequences if it goes off. Bring on Article 2. Bring on the Turkish landfill. You never thought we'd be worrying about a Turkish landfill. Article 2, as I said, creates an obligation on the state to put in place regimes to assess all those measures. So the argument in the Court of Appeal tomorrow is about whether Article 2 does indeed do that and whether indeed there has been a violation in this case of Article 2. All I can say is watch this space. We wait to see what the Court of Appeal does with it. So those are two examples of where, in procedural terms, the Human Rights Act and the European Convention appears to be providing us with some support. Not as much as we thought it might do in the first instance when it first came in. We didn't get the third party rights of appeal and so on, but at least some protections. Unfortunately, and I know Connor's going to talk about this in much more detail in a minute, the same hasn't been true in relation to substantive rights, the right that says that's too noisy or that's too polluting or whatever. The example of that, the classic example of that, and I think Connor's going to talk about this, is the Hatton case, the night flights over Heathrow case, where what the European Court did was to say, yes, we know your Article 8 rights, effectively your rights to respectful family life, but here your right to sleep, sleep peacefully at least, is in play, but the decision as to whether these flights are too noisy and therefore unacceptable in terms of your Article 8 rights is not for the court, that's for the member state, that's for the UK to decide, it's for the UK to decide the balance between your right to sleep and the commercial and other imperatives associated with flying. So the European Court and the European Convention on the Human Rights Act haven't delivered in any real sense on those big substantive rights. There's no equivalent to the benefits that have come in procedural rights. So we've got something out of this rights-based culture for our environmental protection, something expressly beneficial. But I think there's a lot more scope, and I think what we now need to do is to move our thinking on and say the time is right to talk about proper environmental rights in the UK, not just to address the sorts of shortfalls I was talking about, but a whole raft of other things. Let's have in place some framework which provides an ultimate long stop against the interests of commerce, big business, and the political pressures that flow from that. Let me just give you a couple of examples of how that's worked in other countries. In the Spanish constitution, there's an environment, there's a right to enjoy, quotes, an environment suitable for the development of the person. In the Portuguese constitution, it says this: everyone shall have the right to a healthy and ecologically balanced human environment and the duty to defend it. And in the South African constitution, everyone has the right to an environment that's not harmful to their health or well-being. And then in one international court case, the judge said this: the protection of the environment is likewise a vital part of the contemporary human rights doctrine. It goes without saying that within numerous rights, such as the right to health and the right to life itself. So there's plenty of scope in other countries' constitutions and in international thinking to develop proper substantive environmental rights within our system. And I think now's the time to start having that discussion. We can talk about what the ambit of them is, how they're framed, how they look to the difference between narrow human rights and issues around the world in which we live. Questions like sustainability could come into play, and so on. A very interesting discussion to be had. I don't know if any of you, I'll finish at this point, I don't know if any of you listen to the Now show on Radio 4 on a Saturday lunchtime. It's a sort of comedy program, sort of news quiz kind of comedy program. One of the things they were joking about on Saturday was the possibility of Gordon Brown introducing a constitution when he becomes Prime Minister. Now, if that's turned out to be more than a joke, that would obviously be an ideal opportunity to start having some of the kinds of conversations that I've been talking about, starting to talk about developing proper environmental rights. I'll leave you with that thought.
Thanks very much, David. I just want to talk for about 5 minutes or 10 minutes about this title. Because I'm going to make a sort of slightly overstated case that actually there is a problem here of practice and of theory between environmental and human rights. I came to this doing that boring thesis I talked about because it involved me reading extensively about the last great period of environmental energy in this country, mid-19th century, where the horrors of the environmental pollution of the day were being addressed by Parliament in legislation like the Nuisance Removals Acts, in the River Pollution Prevention Act of 1876, Public Health Act of 1875, Alkali Inspectorate of 1863, and so on. Really in the teeth of extreme objections by propertied and powerful entities who deployed not so much the language of human rights as the language of property rights with which to defend their interests against strong governmental regulation. And flash forward to something which was before Parliament in Michael's first term, I think, what became the Control of Pollution Act 1974, which was a strong bill for its time and which was a response to a great explosion of interest in the environment which had culminated in the Stockholm Conference of 1972. And then again, efforts to regulate the environment were being met with what was by now being articulated as human rights concerns. Judges masquerading as legislators in the upper house, ludicrously deferred to by former members of the House of Commons, rewarded with upper house status as a consolation at the end of their careers, talking allegedly knowingly about this and that right, when what they meant were the rights of the powerful to resist change. That's the first point. Second point, I wonder sometimes whether I was wrong to move out of environmental stuff and into what I do, because nobody on the platform yet has just taken a second to notice the enormity of what we are confronted with. And there is a danger that we let it go slightly by default. You know, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, three assessment reports, 1990, 1995, 2001. The one in 2001 was bad enough, and goodness knows what the one in 2007 will be like. But there was an initial interim assessment team meeting in Exeter, February last year, nearly a year ago now. People who were there were shocked by the degree of decline in the environment in the short period since 2001. They'd said 4 years before, for example, the UN people, that the Antarctic ice sheet was secure for maybe, they thought, 1,000 years. 4 years later, they're saying there's a real possibility that it'll break up. Global sea levels rising 16 feet, destroying whole countries, cities, not just in the third world either, the developing world. Secondly, the acidification of the ocean from carbon dioxide actually now threatening the entire food chain. There's concern since then about the slowing down of the Gulf Stream, the melting of the Himalayan glaciers. A report from an American think tank just yesterday reported on BBC News, if China and India were to consume as much resources per capita as Japan in 2030, together they would require a full planet Earth to meet their needs. So if they achieve what Japan does now, they use up all we have. And of course, there's the United States, still by far the biggest consumer. All three, as Michael reminded us, not in the Kyoto Accords. Now, what does this say about human rights? The first 2 points. This is my third of my brief points. Firstly, I think David Wolfe is right. It's difficult to make human rights work for environmental rights. I want to explore why that is the case. David's made, of course, a good point about access to resources. The environmental rights people are usually on the out trying to get in. It's the people who destroy the environment that are in with the resources to keep those out, out. Now, secondly, in this point, I don't want to argue about the need for human rights protection for the powerless. That is a given. The ways in which powerless people, Michael adverted to it, have their lives destroyed by governmental regulation, sometimes in the name of environmental development, sometimes more often in the name of economic development. It goes without saying that rights language should work for them more than it does. I'm concerned about the point drawn from the 19th century. We need radical action and dramatic action to address the environmental challenge. Dramatic action takes on the powerful. It takes on the corporate. It takes on the prosperous individuals. We do not perceive a problem between human rights and environmental protection because we have not yet begun to engage at the level we ought to engage to secure the kind of protection that the environment needs. Were we to do so, we might find ourselves affected by the capacity of the powerful to deploy the language of rights in their protection. Just a few examples. I'm not now necessarily taking a very dismal view about rights. I'm just serving a warning as a route into my fourth point. Property. Well, we can, you know, there is the Jeremy Clarkson kind of point, which is well made. The Telegraph had a front page item about how human rights mean you can't tow cars away. It's nonsense. Absolute nonsense. Of course it is. But what would happen, for example, if we decided we needed to remove all the mobile phone masts? Well, we'd hit the property rights. What would happen if we decided, actually, as a preliminary to a wholesale commitment to public transport, that we would severely restrict car production and import of cars into this country, and that we would renationalize the rail service? Well, we'd hit property entitlement problems then. So I'm saying that it is a measure of our relative blandness that allows us not to detect the contradictions that would emerge. Strong government taking on vested interests in an unequal society can find, if it's not careful, language rooted in rights used against it, because corporate entities and business power deploy what language is available to them as a defensive mechanism. Those who might not believe this, think about the extent to which fair procedures, which can work very well for people of whom we've heard from David, can be deployed by powerful people to destroy legislation. Progressive legislation on race relations, on sex discrimination, snarled up for a while in the hands of a hostile judiciary. We have to be careful. Crimes rooted in absolute liability might run foul of challenges based on burdens of proof and so on. There's a deeper point about human rights language. It is human rights. It's rooted in our species. It's rooted in us. Everything about it is about our flourishing. The civil and political side is about our participating in society. The social and economic side is about our thriving. We can gloss over it, but the reality is it's rooted in a very species-centered approach to this planet. The right to development, similarly. In other words, there's two emphases. There's an emphasis on the human, but there's also a strong emphasis on the here and now. Now, you think about the exceptions to human rights, and they give the game away. Michael talked about, and rightly, that fantastically interesting Pentagon report. Never mind the war on terror, they say, look around you. But the human rights framework has mechanisms to accommodate threats rooted in public emergencies, in this and that terrorist atrocity and so on, in what is needed, what is necessary in a democratic society. It has no equivalent language to accommodate dramatic exceptions that might be required for the protection of the globe, for what Michael referred to as the most important human right of all, the protection of the biosphere, the survival of the human species. How could we not be concerned about that? And not only because 150,000 people alive today are dying every year because of global warming. Well, the human rights community need to be imaginative about how we integrate into this huge problem. And I'm going to suggest a way in which perhaps we can. And then I'll identify some practical things and then I'll stop. Firstly, our subject is about protecting vulnerable people. Our subject is about giving voice to the voiceless. Secondly, our reckless destruction of the planet today comes at a cost to those who must try to live here tomorrow. What we've got at the moment is oppression by a transient majority, those alive today, of huge numbers of people, as yet unborn, who must be given the same chances as we've had to live well. In other words, I'm not trying to run away from the human-centered focus of human rights, but try and make it work. We need to empathize not with people who are alive today who are voiceless, but people who will be alive tomorrow who are voiceless, whose life chances we are destroying. Now, you look at the preamble to the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. Where did that come from? Quote, disregard and contempt for human rights has resulted in, quote again, barbarous acts which have outraged the conscience of mankind. That's what the preamble says. Barbarous acts which have outraged the conscience of mankind. I would call the willful destruction of our planet in the pursuit of short-term profit, summarized as the Cheney approach to human life, as a barbarous act which outrages the conscience of mankind. And then the preamble went on. It is essential, if man is not to be compelled to have recourse as a last resort to rebellion, that human rights should be protected by law. Who's going to represent the desires and wishes of those who in decades to come may curse the conduct of this particular generation with the same venom as we now curse those whose barbarous conduct gave rise to our discourse? Now, the new approach. Well, if we think of ourselves as representatives of the unborn as yet not in the womb, a different form of unborn, you can actually take quite a radical approach to the subject. Four things. There is no environmental bill of rights. It seems unbelievable. We're not pushing hard at the United Nations towards something with the same energy and determination as we have done in other fields, entrenching for future generations not a guarantee of human enjoyment, but a guarantee of global survival. The UN should be doing an awful lot more, leading on, for example, carbon debt. I think Michael's idea about a World Environment Court is a fantastic idea, which oversees the application of the Environmental Bill of Rights, and which does trump international capital. An Environmental Bill of Rights which is devoted to sustainability and which sees our temporary ownership of the world as in the form of a trusteeship. Secondly, more close to home, imaginative lawyers like David. Let's give elements in the environment legal personality. Has it ever struck you as odd that if I fall over and a small part of my finger is damaged, I can sue and recover damages from those whose negligence caused it? But if a river is destroyed by a corporate entity, it is fined, if it is fined at all, under the criminal system, a somewhat derisory sum of money. Why not have a public official on the model of the persons who are acting as guardians for children and mentally unwell? Why not have such persons sue on behalf of the destroyed environment? So that if there is a pollution spill and it can be shown to have been caused by negligence, the river sues, or the trees that have been destroyed sue, through the agency of a trustee. And of course then insurance would cover it and we'd pay for it, but there'd be proper money flowing back to environmental recovery. Three, David's touched on this very well, and I need say very little other than to explain his reference to Hatton, imaginative use of current rights instruments. By imaginative, I might mean legally reckless. Legally reckless. The right to respect for privacy in Article 8 of the European Convention has been wonderfully misapplied to cover environmental law. Marvellous. Now, I have a slight guilt about this fantastic case called Hatton in the United Kingdom. These people can't sleep because the aeroplanes are in Heathrow during the early morning and late night. They are given their marching orders by a large bunch of European judges, a very small number before that, having said that they could sleep and you must close Heathrow down, rather frightened the government and others. I thought that the large court that had let the government off the hook by saying that Article 8 wasn't engaged were right. But actually, forget about their sleep and think about air travel and think about the scandalous way in which, without considering it, we are permitting such a vast extension of air travel. And think about maybe deploying the sort of, if you want, kind of slightly tendentious commitment to sleep of persons who've bought houses in the Heathrow area as a means to an end, which is some effort to reduce the extravagant overuse of flights today. So maybe Hatton was, to some extent, less wrong than I thought. And fourthly and finally, apart from a new Environmental Bill of Rights, new elements of legal personality for the natural objects around us, imaginative use of current rights instruments, a new invigoration of the political community which links the environmental and the human rights people, which links them. I have to say, we were very anxious to have a number of well-known environmental NGOs here today. But for one reason or another, it's not perceived as within their world. Well, I think it's a pity they don't see that. Because actually, if you look back to the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, this talk about needing this to prevent action against tyranny is a very, very strong human rights language, but it's also the language of direct action. It's the language of environmental movement. It's the language about forcing things onto center stage. The human rights movement knows that, because the human rights movement was born out of an awareness that we must never again have a situation where politics cannot cope and human rights cannot cope with such oppression. So I think there's lots of potential conflict between the two if we're not careful. But human rights should ensure that it draws the environmental into a broad coalition, because the lessons from other countries are things like the environment, which remain isolated from the mainstream of other public interest groups, die the death. They have to form alliances or die. And so I really feel both that there's a risk, but that the risk must be overcome. And I see the chair waving at me, telling me I've far exceeded my 5 minutes, so I better draw to a conclusion. Thank you very much. Okay, we have a few minutes for questions, and there will be drinks afterwards. I wonder whether anybody would like to kick off with questions. If you could do so, keeping the question reasonably succinct, and also saying who you are, if you want, or where you're from. Do we have any questions for any speaker? We have a lady here. Should we take you, madam?
Hello, Debbie Bryce. Is the Aarhus Convention a start at combining these two areas?
Pardon?
Is the Aarhus Convention a start at combining these two areas?
Are you directing that to me?
Any of you.
Yeah, do you want to take that?
Say that again.
Could you explain the first bit of the question?
The Aarhus Convention.
I'll take that. The Aarhus Convention is a convention which was signed and agreed by ministers in Europe, about 3-4 years ago, which requires the dissemination of environmental information and enables the facilities for citizens to participate in protecting their environment within democracies in Western Europe. It is a means of ensuring that more information is made available. For example, if you live in an area where you have a chemical institution, chemical factory, a refinery, say within a few miles away, one of the things you must wonder is quite what effect the discharges have on the waterways or on the lakes, which you often find outside refineries, or discharges into the atmosphere. How many of those are health undermining, how many of them may even be potentially lethal? One doesn't know. What this Aarhus Convention does is to enable you as a citizen to require the government to provide information to you about the nature of the air and the constituent particles or gases which may be found in it. The British government had already gone some way in that direction, but the Aarhus Convention goes further. It has a wider range than indigenous legislation, and I think it is very useful. The one weakness in my view, and Connor I think was touching on this at one point, is that people should have the capacity to bring cases. Now, as has been said by David, it costs a lot of money. Therefore, why shouldn't that case be able to be brought by environmental NGOs, if you can persuade them to do so, and the cost of it covered by a public interest fund? I think that's the right model. I know about it because I proposed that when I was in government, and I have to say that other departments were simply not prepared to agree. That would, of course, enormously increase the capacity of the citizen and of the environmental NGOs to get back at the big industrial and business interests, and they weren't going to have that. Because really central to all of this is governments in all countries, certainly in this country, perhaps more than most, is very much on the side of industry, of business, and whatever they say, the environment is much less high in the political agenda than it ought to be. I think that's a central weakness. But Aarhus was very helpful.
And David, briefly, I think.
Connor talked about rights in relation to future generations and so on, what's called in the jargon intergenerational equity or sustainability. And Aarhus is actually very strong on that. Let me just quote you from Article 1 of the Aarhus Convention. It says that the objective of the convention is to contribute to the protection, quotes, of the right of every person of the present and future generations to live in an environment adequate to his or health, adequate to his health and well-being. So although it's only about information and so on, as Michael says, it does have this additional quite nuanced flavour that Connor was mentioning.
So my answer is obviously yes. Do we have any other questions? Lady at the back. Just could you wait until the microphone comes and then give your name if you want.
My name is Julia Welshman and I campaign for the right of children to use their school grounds. Against all odds, it would seem, the ASBO should be now applied to BAA and properly termed the ASBAR, We need to stop these large corporations ruining our human habitat. There are very few small spaces left for children that are designated and state-funded and maintained. And on many of them, affected by aviation in particular, air pollution and noise, they are unable to be used appropriately. And this habitat is being lost. I hope that you won't wait until you're my age, audience, to find this out with your own children. And I hope that you will perhaps act when you see an invitation to do so. The ASBAR, right?
Right. Well, I think I'll take that as a sort of, as a comment, which may or may not provoke remarks. And I'll now take the gentleman right at the back, and then this gentleman here, and then perhaps go to the speakers. But thank you.
I'm Daniel Nelson. I'm a journalist. I think you've seriously underrated the gap between the human rights and environmental movements on a number of grounds. I think there's still an enormous gap, and I've been a bit involved in trying to get the human rights movements to take on climate change arguments, and they are absolutely resisting it, both for tactical reasons and for other reasons, and they will not use global justice arguments linked with climate change. And I think there's a real hostility, and it is a barrier, and I think you haven't quite addressed some that issue, which is in the headline of the meeting, but
I mean, from your perspective, elaborate just very briefly on exactly why the human rights movement, in your judgment, is so anxious not to get involved?
I think some of it is tactical. They think it will complicate an already what is a fairly straightforward human rights argument, which they feel they can win, whereas climate change is still contested on various levels, so they don't want to muddy their own water. Mm-hmm. And I think there are other reasons too, but not for me to go into it now.
There may be members from NGOs involved in the environment here who might want to, or in human rights, who might want to respond.
Can I very briefly respond? I mean, I did give two instances of the way in which I think we should do exactly what you're talking about, but I don't think one should also underestimate the difficulties of doing it, because if you go to a court of law, you do have to identify the party very clearly who you are holding responsible for the damage that has been done. And with a lot of environmental issues, that linkage, even though most of us think it is pretty clear, whether it's actually going to stand up to the kind of forensic cross-examination which the big companies will certainly get the best silks in order to protect them, and you actually have to prove that connection. It's not they have to disprove it. And actually, I think that's pretty difficult. So I think we should do exactly what you're saying, but maybe one reason why they're not very willing to do it is, as I say, I'm not a lawyer. It's actually very difficult to make these cases stand up in a court of law.
David, do you want to comment or come back later? I've got three people caught my eye, all males, so it's an unusual thing, four males in a row at a Human Rights Centre talk. But the gentleman up here, and then there's a gentleman right here, and then there's this gentleman. Since we are moving ahead in time, succinct interventions will be appreciated.
I think the panel very much agrees with each other, but I'd like to introduce a note of scepticism. Many of the statements made by Michael Meacher, as if they were absolute undisputed fact, come, I think, mainly from the International Panel on Climate Change, to which reference has been made. But they were roundly attacked by the House of Lords Select Committee, which is normally an extremely mild body in what it says. They're accused of bias. They're accused of not paying proper attention to cost-benefit analysis, and they were accused of not paying any attention, really, to the benefits of global warming as opposed to the disadvantages of it. And to take one example from a statement made from the panel, 150,000 people dying every year because of global warming. There are certainly scientists who think that global warming saves more lives than it costs.
And, sir, did you exercise a right to privacy by not telling us who you were, or would you like to...
Stuart Wheeler.
Thank you very much. You've waived your right to privacy, which is excellent. thank you very much, Mr. Wheeler. The gentleman up here, and there was somebody who caught my eye and then stopped catching my eye, but we'll take you first.
G. Leslie. Don't we need key UN agencies such as the Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Health Organization, for example, to be freed from multinational penetration, e.g., Monsanto with genetically modified foods, etc., etc., on the one hand, and on the other, I fear we're ignoring the fact that we're not ignoring, but there are problems with regard to human rights and environmental movements when you have the World Wildlife Organization in Kenya, in the Kalahari, where bushmen are forced out of reserves. Shouldn't we be making sure that we stick up for the rights of indigenous peoples because through doing that, we will also be protecting the environment and not misunderstand the fact that these people have been caring for nature in their way and not get WWF to be, in certain ways, being used by various governments and various other things.
Thank you. And before we go back to the panel, this gentleman in the front here. And
hi. Yeah. I just wondered.
And your name?
My name is Michael Paulin. I just wondered if you could say something about whether or not groups like Greenpeace are more likely to be granted judicial review than individuals who may have a sufficient interest in the matter. And also, it just seems that an environmental bill of rights is kind of necessary because typically environmental rights are collective things, and it seems that at least within the human rights movement, the general views that human rights are just individualistic, or at least ascribed to individuals exclusively, and there's a kind of perhaps philosophical tension there. So, thanks.
Thank you. I think we could take David and then Michael on these. Thank you very much.
I'd just like to answer really the first half of your question there about judicial review and NGOs. You mentioned Greenpeace as an example. I think the court climate now is actually relatively friendly towards people having standing to bring these kinds of challenges. So at least in theory, in many instances, Greenpeace or Friends of the Earth or whoever have found themselves just as able to bring the challenges as would an individual. The problem, however, is that those bodies, if we're looking at, say, Human Rights Act framework and the current Human Rights Act, those bodies are most unlikely to be victims. So they can get through the door of the court, have standing, but not necessarily be able to raise the kinds of arguments we've talked about. But obviously, they can raise other arguments.
And Michael, would you like to take?
First of all, can I ask Mr. Wheeler whether you have any connection with the oil industry? Right. Well, that's quite surprising because the views that you expressed are those commonly expressed by the apologists on behalf of ExxonMobil. But you may, of course, have your own reasons for holding those views, and I respect that. On the other hand, I do think the balance of credibility is overwhelmingly against what you've said. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is made up of 2,000 to 3,000 scientists from countries all across the world. There have, as Connor said, been 3 reports. They've progressively been refining their theory, and there are ways of indicating the correctness of that theory. I'll just give, one example, of course, is obviously the increasing evidence of greater frequency and ferocity of climatic phenomena, exactly what you would expect if climate change is occurring. But more particularly, they included sulfate aerosols within the theory in the latest, the 3rd report, and that enables them to make, on the basis of the theory, what they believe on the basis of that theory would have been the temperature over the last 100 years. They can calculate backwards, and you can then compare independently with what we actually know the average global temperatures were, and we find that there's an almost total fit. So all that I can say is, okay, we don't know everything about climate change, that is perfectly true, but I reckon we know about 98%, and that small amount, perhaps to do with the effects of volcanism, perhaps to do with solar cycles, there may well be other things which do affect the climate, as well as variability in the climate over the ages. That, of course, is also true. But there are hardly any reputable scientists outside those paid by the oil industry who will actually say that climate change is not happening. And I believe those words have actually passed the mouth of President Bush, which is really the final confirmation that there might be something in it. On the question of the WWF and the Kalahari Desert, I don't know about the particular. I would be amazed if WWF were in any way involved in removing bushmen from their habitat and their livelihood. I would be astonished. I'd like to know the circumstances if that was true. With regard to the Food and Agriculture Organization, I very much agree It is, of course, a UN institution and therefore ought to be independent. But there is no doubt the influence of the US is enormous, and the capacity of the big US organizations like Monsanto to influence the judgments and the composition of some of those institutions, particularly FAO, because they're so interested in it because of genetic modification, is very powerful. And you're absolutely right, we should demand absolute independence, independence from commercial influence, if you're going to get integrity and justice.
I'm going to test the water for extreme interest in very, very succinct final two contributions. Two further men have caught my eyes, other than the environment of such a masculine subject, masculine panel, masculine interventions. Got this gentleman here. Very, very quick, if you would, please, because we're going to wrap up with this. But beforehand, possibly because the microphone is closer, this gentleman here.
British version, Joe Holm of the Environment Council. It took the Second World War to derive the United Nations and the Security Council. What will it take to set up, in terms of global governance, a UN Environment Council?
Thank you.
Ten very Katrinas. Nice one. Ten Katrinas all directed at the United States. Then it'll happen.
I think that's the interesting. There was an interesting point just after Katrina, whether there would have been another one, do you remember? And
yeah,
I mean, it would have been quite interesting. But we'll take that as an answer, given the push for time. Has the gentleman found a microphone?
Joseph O'Reilly. I just wanted to very briefly return to this question about the capacity of the two movements to work together. Having witnessed at relatively close quarters Amnesty International's attempt to move from its civil and political rights mandate to economic, social and cultural rights, which took a very long time and was fraught with great difficulties, I don't hold out much hope for the human rights establishment or for the environmental establishment to lead the sort of convergence that's obviously so necessary around these two issues. And I suspect that it's probably going to be a kind of a third party that brings about the convergence and, you know, cooperation that's necessary. One final thing I would say is that I would have thought that most green political parties would have staked their claim to these issues, because they certainly use the language of human rights, social justice and the environment, but I suspect, you know, that recent history has proven that they haven't proved very successful, and I wonder what the hope is for that, because clearly in terms of the analysis that each of the speakers gave around the confluence of political and industrial interests stopping human rights and environmental protection, we also need political representation that takes up these issues.
It's almost a standalone comment. I'm looking around and I'm asking whether either of our guests might want to make concluding remarks, and then we'll wrap it up. But whether or not we feel we've said enough?
I've got nothing specific to say. I mean, I think it's been an extremely good debate. I think some, leaving me aside, some extremely good contributions, and I think let's get into discussion over a drink, which is, I'm sure, what is holding people to remain.
Since as chair I began to speak, Michael has retaliated by starting to chair. But what Michael doesn't know, in fact, is that we have another, we hope it'll be a terrific talk by Kirsten Sellers on Trying Saddam. On the 2nd of February, so that's a date for your diary. I hope you've got this or can get it. It's a lunchtime talk. And then we have Louise Auber, who's the UN Commissioner for Human Rights, coming here, very, very important figure in the world of human rights at the UN level, talking about human rights in an age of uncertainty. That's on the 16th of February this coming month. Let me say now that the drinks to which you are all invited, repeat all, we have never had a function at the Human Rights Centre without a piece of alcohol afterwards, I think, other than the morning seminars where we draw the line at that. and it's on the fifth floor. There are two lifts. The LSE tries to prevent you going there by having only two lifts, sometimes neither working. It's the fifth floor. It's the senior common room. There will be signs there. You are more than welcome, and especially those of us who want to debate the issues from sceptical perspectives. You're all welcome. We're a very broad church, including those of us who do not work for the oil industry. And we'll see you all upstairs to carry on the discussion. But now let's end with a round of applause before you stand up for our speaker. Thank you. Thank you. Good.